Good afternoon.
Before we start, we are going to, so we've made a schedule for this specific session, and because we have two speakers, and I'm going to talk about very empirical studies, and for Abu Zaik, his talk is more theoretical. So,
yes, it's perhaps even more philosophical. It's not maybe perhaps theory, but it's, I want to ask some fundamental questions. They could be very practical, they could be very abstract or whatever. So, and I think that's the way it should be because we have different people coming here. So,
well,
yes, okay. Yeah, my presentation could be concrete on the ground and it could be airy in the Platonic world as well. So,
right, so the end of this, the objective of this session will be try to combine the theoretical part as well as the phenomenological part, and if some of you might argue that what is more important. But firstly, we have a couple of questions we want to ask the audience. The first question we are curious about is how are you going to define what is hacker? So we would like to ask each participant here to use a term or any description and to describe very briefly how you define what is hacker. So can we start from Raul? Yes.
So normally, a hacker is a person who's passionate by programming.
Mm-hmm.
It's a definition given by humanity. And from programming means to work with special products, which is software. Digitalize groups. And as a consequence of being passionate by programming, you got to be people's passion by working with a new tool, a new product, which has new capacities, magic capacities. That's what we mean. Hacker.
Right. Thank you.
I think hackers are something like modern mathematicians. They simple things like little bit of bits and software and stuff and do magic things out there, things you never thought that were possible before. I think things are like more than more general approach to hackers, which don't apply to software developments, but also applies to people who make chat engine as well.
Basically, it's also a question of programming and maybe reverse engineering in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I have a moral passion that is starting to work, which somehow fixed in my head and I can't change it. I think a hacker is somebody who tries to make quick changes to something without necessarily really understanding it and tries to like, force it, something to work without really a very systematic approach.
For me, that this connotation of hacking into something which is like a secret or something which nobody went there before, I don't know, Changi. You go through time here, but you can't go.
Addiction or something.
No, dense forest. To hack into a
dense
forest.
Sorry.
It cuts into a jungle through every.
Sorry.
Exploring.
Yeah. Could it be like this?
Yes. Okay.
Something like destroying. Something. It has a connotation of destruction. Yes.
Yeah, I think my notion of hacker is very much written down there. Passion, for instance, and not only software, but also say an only engineering. I think, for instance, cooking or something like that.
Cooking.
hacked also.
My background is as an artist, so what I observe very often amongst my colleagues that will have this hacker mentality, which is for me sort of constructively breaking things apart to learn and reconstruct them.
I would also thought of a hacker as something that has to do with mentality, with a kind of culture, going beyond any superficial layers of programming, going to the core, understanding and changing it.
Yes.
For me, there is a person who brings great art for this.
Could you say again, please?
What was it?
Offer. She said offer?
Artful. Okay. Here about artful.
So I suppose one definition of a hacker, if you get abstracted a little, is someone who practices their craft in a playful and enthusiastic manner.
Playful. Thank you for you all. And as you can see, that there's no single definition about what is hacker, and this is so. That's the reason why we both think hacker is actually an interpretable notion rather than a decisive, definite norm. So what we are going to do is it's something really could be interpreted and could be played. And how are we going to use this mentality to implement this culture in our software design, as well as probably in a wider societal design nation, how to develop our society. So, perhaps, Abzai, you would like to start your talk?
Yes. Well, what struck me before I went here is that I would have a hard time to explain what a hacker is, but it doesn't seem to be that hard, because my conception of a hacker is close to what has been said, and I have to admit I'm not a hacker in the ordinary sense, at least myself. I don't do programming, and I don't. I haven't been sharing my software because I haven't done any and stuff like that. So, well, but I've tried to look at hacking as a philosophy, a way of life, and it's an ethical way to live your life. The hacker ethic is about right and wrong. Ethics is about right and wrong. It has to do with your character. The original term, ethos, has had to do about your character. So it has to do with also with codes and principles of our behavior. The hacker ethic, then, is about hackers' conceptions of what is right and what is wrong. So, what is a hacker? We already gone through that, and I think we could agree to a large degree on what has been said. And I'm going to take three steps. First, to see what is a hacker. When did the hacker ethic as such, under the term hacker ethic, appear? And what is at stake with the interpretations of the hacker ethic that has been put forward in books mainly? So you see, I'm not talking about crackers, and you all said something that didn't have to do with cracking. Nobody was talking about breaking the law. So a lot of hackers have actually tried to stretch the limit and use the law in unseen ways, but still within the law. A lot of people, we have to remember that, would call themselves hackers, while they would be more like cracking things. So, but I'm not talking about crackers or even black hats. It's not my subject. The first hackers came at the... the first modern hackers had its roots at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Some of you might know that. They had a train model railroad club, and they had a dictionary. A dictionary took up the word hack from the original MIT sense. It was more like a prank, fun stuff, gluing a table to the ceiling and gluing, including the paper so that the whole room would turn upside down. It's not easy to do that. So it's, you have to be clever to do it right, and people will get surprised and it will be funny. And that is still a hack at MIT. But the guys at this club, they had a new word, and I think it was Graham who said that he's an old school. Perhaps he would like to see hacking in the ordinary sense. And I agree that it has to do with getting things that didn't work to work with simple, efficient means. And therefore, you can also say that you can hack in any domain. As according to the dictionary says, an article or project without a constructive end, that's a hack. Word undertaken under bad self-advice. Basically, a hacker is just one who produces hack in this sense. So that's the first conception of a hacker back in the late 50s. Later on, there were Stephen Levy. Some of you have probably read that book. Can I see your hands if you have read that? Not many have read it, okay. So Stephen Levy is the first to introduce the term hacker ethics, and it's done based on studies where he interviewed people like Richard Stallman, but also people from the hardware hackers. So he has already... He already back in the 80s did a study on those free hardware, probably you could say, and free software, even though that free software wasn't termed until Stallman's GNU project started. Then in the Hacker's Dictionary, we have the original sense of a hacker. Hacker, someone who makes furniture with an axe. Who of you knew that? So we have a person who enjoys learning the details of programming systems and how to stretch their capabilities, as opposed to most users who prefer to learn only the minimum necessary. But you see, at this time, the Hacker Dictionary, it's not the same as the train model railroad club, so it has become a culture actually. It's not just a way to fix things. It's more like a mind state. And this dictionary was involved at Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. Today we have Eric Raymond's jargon file, and it's actually some of the old school hackers don't like it because it's more like a culture, like popular culture. It's like going to the movies and going to Hollywood movies and watch hackers, and I'm a hacker and everybody's a hacker and hacking is cool and stuff like this. But we still have the notion that information sharing is a powerful, positive good, and it's an ethical duty of hackers to share their expertise by writing open source code and facilitating access to information and to computing resources wherever possible. Actually, this is the first entry on hacking and hackers. There's a lot of there's 6 or 7 standard ways of defining hackers today, but I think this sums up what's important in the earlier sense as well. So this is what I'll stick to in my presentation. So, first step, what is at stake when we talk about hacker ethics? It's not just programming. So, in 2001, Pekka Himanen, a Finnish philosopher, wrote The Hacker Ethic and the Spirit of the Information Age. It is the first title of a book proclaiming to give an account of the so-called hacker ethic. The book's prologue is by famous hacker Linus Torvalds, and the epilogue is by sociologist Manuel Castells. The main theme in Himanen's book is this: the hacker ethic as a challenge to contemporary society in order to change society for the better. Of course, you can see there is some of you, and I would like to ask you later what you see as Germans. Does it really extend what Max Weber wrote? Because the title is obviously the same, but something has changed in the title. We no longer have the Protestantische Ethik, we have the Hacker Ethic, and we have no longer have the Geist des Kapitalismus, we have the Information Age, spirit of that age. So is it possible that we live in a new age? Is it possible that we live with a new set of values? So you see from the title that Pekka Himanen is concerned about this topic. It's not just programming, it's about a cultural dimension, it's a historical dimension. It will be at that, probably that level the next 5 or 10 minutes. So before going in details with what Himanen has said, I would like to try to give my presentation on Weber's book, actually. So the main concern for Weber was, why was it that only in the West we had a rational mathematics? Why was it that only in the West physics as it appeared, how come we didn't see that in other places? And why was it that when we had Aristotle, we didn't have rational economic? But you know, Aristotle wrote on economic, but we didn't have the same rational model of economics as we have today. So this is what caused, actually, the rational capitalist society. After the Reformation, Weber thought that we, for the first time, saw capitalism in a rational form. We had seen rational sciences, but we had seen economical systems, and we had seen capitalist systems. We didn't see rational economical systems before the Reformation had taken place. So, In Weber's book, published Die Protestantische Ethik und der Geist des Kapitalismus, we saw that the historical presuppositions were actually the Protestant ethic in order to get to the spirit of capitalism. How is this coming up? We're talking about the Protestant ethic, and we're talking about spirit of capitalism. What is these two entities? Basically, it's ideal types in the academical sense. It's a model. I don't want to go with this. So, okay, his presentation, in my opinion, is this. The Protestant ethic describes religious otherworldly and ascetics who followed God's commands. According to different Reformed religious sects, sects who evolved from Reformation, beginning with Martin Luther's call for a more strict, puritanical, and innerworldly Christianity. Followers of the Protestantic ethic, people seeking the otherworldly, the God sphere, but living in this world, could not be certain that they would end up with God. In fact, they would be in doubt whether or not they would go to heaven in this, so they would have to look for some signs telling them that they were actually true to God. it's a popular version of what he said, and I'm not a scholar in this, but I think it comes close to what he has said in this book. And so we have this group of people working harder and more focused. They would not let girls, booze, and jolly parties disturb their calling, that is to serve God faithfully and enter the kingdom of God. But choosing to work harder and better than the rest, they thought that they could get a hint, just a tiny amount of certainty, whether or not they would end up in heaven. The Protestant chose this way of life. At that time, he was free to choose. Choosing that way of life actually led religious Protestants to a higher social ranking than other religious sects. At least that was one of Weber's conclusions. Protestants followed the call of God through the Bible instead of the Catholic Pope in Rome. And thereby they withdrew themselves from a traditional society who is linked to the Pope, and it had its strong norms and its superstructures. The Protestant agent connected themselves into a rational capitalistic economy oriented by the market. A clear divide between the economy of the household and the enterprise, and the what is basically said is that we divide the economy of the household and we from the economy of the enterprise. Before this time, we had a strong connection between household economy. We wouldn't go to a factory and work. We would arrange our activities at home, like some free software is done today, actually. So we had a connected sphere of our work life and our daily life. But at that time, we saw the divide for the first time between the household economy and the enterprise. So, we have this quote from Weber saying, "The Puritan wanted to work in a calling. We are forced to do so. For when asceticism was carried out of monastic cells into everyday life and began to dominate worldly morality, it did its part in building the tremendous cosmos of the modern economic order. This order is now bound to the technical and economic conditions of machine production, which today determines the life of all individuals who are born into this mechanism, not only those directly concerned with economic acquisition, with irresistible force. Perhaps it will so determine them until the last ton of fossils coal is burned. Perhaps it will so determine them until the last ton of fossils coal is burned. In Baxter's view, the care for external goods should only lie on the shoulders of the saint, like a light cloak, which can be thrown aside at any moment. But fate decreed that the cloak should become an iron cage. So, in this iron cage, they started living their lives. What was seen before as a chosen way of life, but no longer a chosen way of life. It was a life followed by a Protestant at the beginning, but as soon as they raised to a higher ranking, they would start losing control over the system, and in fact the system would in the end determine how our lives were. The Western world can indeed be seen as an extremely complex mechanism. Building complex systems can be done in several ways, but there should be a freedom of choice, freedom to cooperate, and freedom to change the most important systems for the better. Building better systems and a better society is what the hacker ethic is all about. The similarity between Weber's and Jimenez's title is everything but a chance. Jimenez, in effect, picking up on Weber's work, their intention is somewhat the same. However, in order to account for the hacker ethic, Jimenez explicitly and consciously equates the Protestant ethic with the capitalist spirit. That means he does not see a divide between the Protestants and the actual system that came to be afterwards, that is the capitalist society. Weber didn't say that. He said that first there was the Protestant ethic, and their way of life determined future society. It was not meant to be that. In fact, Protestant ethic and money was not connected, but it somehow ended up that way. But to him, and it's important to see that he says this is a way of putting it. So I'm just saying that we have the Protestant and we have the hacker, and we have the Protestant ethics and we have the hacker ethic, and I'll oppose them, and I'll show you how to crack this iron cage, set you free, perhaps. So, Jimenez finds that the hacker ethic distinguishes from the Protestant ethic in three dominant domains. That is, the hacker's work ethic, the hacker's money ethic, and the hacker's network ethic. He calls the last nethic. Some of you might have heard the term before. The work ethic says that work should be done with an intrinsic interest and enthusiasm which makes work a joy. Work should not just be work, but first of all passion. Raoul was the first to mention passion. Some others were saying the same. And it's a basic, I think it's a commonly agreed that passion, instead of a dull, boring work, is to prefer. So it would seem. In this case, work is a duty for the Protestant. Money is the highest goal. Motivation comes from outside only, going to heaven, earning more money in order to know that you're close to God, and later on, money, when God didn't play that role. Money in itself was enough and still is enough for many people to go to work every day. The hackers prefer passion, first of all. Money is secondary, and motivation comes from inside, because the work, going to work, is, as I said, intrinsic, is of intrinsic interest. Good examples. Ancient philosophers, Plato was the first to say so, that when he started doing philosophy together with Socrates, he felt that a light lighted up, and he became very devoted to philosophy. You all know he founded the academy back in the 400 before Christ, and it lasted actually for 900 years and has been determining our whole Western society. So we have this rational aspect here in some sense. We have artists. You were talking about artists. You're a musician, right? So, no?
No, visual artists.
Okay, a visual artist. Okay, but doing hacking, finding interest in what you're doing, is as we have agreed upon, is not. It doesn't have to be in programming. It could be like visual creations. It could be in economics. It could be in whatever. And we also have professionals, a lot of football players. You've seen them. They love what they're doing. And they are extremely well paid. And even though they don't get paid and no more, they probably continue to play football. And it should be said that good examples of Protestants could be dull workers, not people who don't like the work, but just go there to in order to cash the checks. It could be also be career-minded people who'd go to work in order to receive higher social ranking, more money, or in order to do something else. But the work as such is not the basic thing about going to work. We have the money ethic. Many of you have probably read Just for Fun. Is it the case? Please raise your hand if it is. No? A few have read it. Linus Torvalds is a good example that passion is perhaps the most interesting aspect of hacking. We also have the capitalist hacker, according to him, and then Stephen Wozniak, who's left Apple with lots and lots of money. He doesn't have to work in the traditional sense no more. He's actually living like Plato did back in the academy. He was so rich that he didn't have to work either. And in fact, Himenon compares the people in that it's possible in the Western society to gain so much money, you know, that you are free to do whatever you like, actually. And this is just a good example to say that Wozniak was a capitalist hacker. And of course, we have Richard Stallman, who says that in order to be able to do what I like and hack, I have to be free to share my source, and I have to have a community, and that's what matters most to me. So we have these different conceptions of hackers relating to money. And we have the most archetype, the most fundamental sentence in capitalist society, that is, time is money, mentioned by Franklin. And Weber refers to him, Himmanen refers to him, and everybody today knows that when you go to work, there's some sort of deep connection between time and money. So, and we have Bill Gates, skillful programmer, but not following the hacker ethic by sharing your source or anything. So perhaps not. We could come back to Bill Gates' example. I think it's an odd example at in many different ways. So the largest aspect of all comes into the network ethic. The network ethics is not just about computer networks, it's about ways of getting information, ways of sharing information, and if you are at the center of a network, if you have a lot of information coming in to you, and you can, and you are in the power to withhold that information and perhaps sell it under a copyright license and stuff like that, you have a powerful position. It goes, I don't need have to explain it really, but network is a lot of things. What characterizes the hackers' networks is that they're inclusive in order to make sharing and caring possible. Capitalist networks excludes in order to divide, dominate, and I don't know if it's milk cash, but it's like this. As when you're in the right position, you can do like this on a system and you get money coming out. So it's in order to make a lot of money, you should be able to create exclusive networks. The hacker network ethic seeks to include and avoid exclusion. There is no discrimination based on age, educational level, religion, skin color, or whether or not you are a competitor on the economical market. The network hacker's network ethic says that you should be able to join, and when you enter the common network, you should still have constitutional rights, like that of human rights, that is, freedom of speech, right to privacy, and so on. When people are excluded, you can no longer care for him. So, by allowing everyone to enter the network in a common community, members have a chance to care. It's not, to give an example, that it's not possible to care in a excluding network. It would be very easy to come up with an example. For example, sharing your software. It's not if your friends have the need for a software system, you can't actually share that. So you're not given the chance of you can care, but it doesn't matter. You're not allowed to do so. If you care and if you share, policemen will come after you and you'll end up in problems. So sooner or later, you end up saying, it's not my problem, he can get his own system. So in the end, there's no caring in exclusive systems if they work. And you know, they actually work very, very well. So to bring it all together, we should say that the division between household and enterprise was very important step. Capitalist spirit became a superstructure and an inescapable iron cage. Hackers are trying to crack the lock to the cage. So this is an exception. Hackers don't crack normally, but in this sense, it's about paving the way for freedom. So, and it's not illegal probably to crack that, because is our common legal system. We want to change it at times, but this time hackers see that they have a much better solution to this problem. Therefore, the term is a good term chosen by Himanen. So, I have promised to give a service pack, and I don't think that coming too close to what is actually said in Himanen's, I would just say that when we do a comparison of two types of ethics, we always have the problem of should we prefer one to the other, and it's obvious that what has been done by Himanen is that he chose the hacker ethic from the beginning, and therefore he would like to oppose them in order to get readers' attention to his hacker ethic. And I think if you want to know something about hacker ethic, you should consult Himanen's work. It's marvelous in details, and there's a lot of historical things that could make your head spin for hours. So, but what was Himanen's intention? It was to find how come economical capitalist rationalist systems take control. And actually, while his project was that of a historical description, he came up with some source code to our system, because the system is complex. Our modern system is very complex, actually, and describing fraction of it can be complicated. But I think that by saying that we have a way of seeing how things evolved, we have a way of seeing how Protestant ethic, quite surprising, ended up paving the way for capitalist society. We also have some source code behind this modern world as we live in today. So therefore, we should go for the historical rational events described by Weber, if we want to hack this society, perhaps we could say. And actually, for many hackers, rationality plays a large, important role in their daily life. It's of intrinsic interest for most people. Gifted people, bright geniuses like a lot of hackers, to actually follow the logic of the system, follow how is this linked together, what happens if I change this little tiny bit, and what does happen in the end. So therefore we should really look for a rationality inside our not only our present society. We should look for rationality in the way Weber actually looked at it. And what Weber thought about the Protestant was not that the Protestant as such was the cause, the one with the whip standing and punishing everybody else. It was actually for the first time, a free individual way to look at the Bible. It was the first time we had the free labor market, formerly free labor market. And opposing the Protestant with the hacker is not for me to see the right way to do it, but it can be useful at times. But we have to remember, they chose it themselves to lead a life of a pure life in a call for God. So they had some intention of doing something good. And while some of you might call yourself a hacker, you perhaps also have an intention of going for something that is good. You might think that sharing is good, but sharing is not always good. You could not, you should not share your information with criminals that would use it in. Indeed, you should not share your chemical weapon programs with neither the U.S. or Iraq, perhaps. So I have to finish off soon, but I found that a focus on rationality with rationality indeed is characterizing some of the greatest hackers of all time. Hackers like Socrates, Plato, Immanuel Kant, and yes, Richard Stallman. In fact, I would in order not to diffuse what has been said, we have to remember that hackers were those making furnitures with an axe. So when did we start using axe? It's the first example of human history, in fact. So we have human culture starting from using tools, and using tools in order to lead a more comfortable life, in order to live a better life. And therefore I would say hackers like Socrates, Plato, Kant, and yes, Richard Stallman. We've seen that the GNU general public license has kept free software alive. One of the main reasons is that the license obeys the copyright law. It not only obeys the printed law, but it obeys the original spirit of that law. It obeys the copyright law and is used contrary to the mainstream usage, that is, dividing, dominating, and cashing money from people by imposing ridiculous restriction on how to share your software, books, and in general useful knowledge. If Stallman didn't knew how the legal system worked, if he hadn't taken time to track the implicit rationality of the system, his hack probably wouldn't have worked. The hacker ethic is about sharing and community for sure, but in order to get to that point, important steps are to be taken. It has to do with freedom, moral feelings, and taking action. When done in the hacker movements, some call it hacktivism, following an ethic or some belief that they don't have to call anything. What is important here is not the name, but being able to reuse your wisdom. Therefore, in a double sense, it makes sense to call it something simple and understandable. So, in order to conclude, freedom weighs more than money in the hacker ethic. Hacking is a passion and not necessarily, hacking is also about reaching better systems and society. Inclusive networks is important in order to have sharing, caring, and free communities and societies. Okay, so this was the dense presentation of what Weber has said and what Himanen has said. And I think that when we draw the historical line back to Plato, and if everyone can accept that, we should be able to come up with some examples that the hacker ethic is actually worth practicing. And I have two examples for you. The first is free software teaches us something important about ethics. In Richard Stallman's The GNU Manifesto, Immanuel Kant is mentioned. The free software movement were inspired by the Declaration of Independence. Universities such as MIT provides course material under the Creative Commons license, open courseware. And perhaps this comes as a surprise to many of you, I don't know. Free software, has it anything to do with 4th of July? Sure. That was probably his Stallman's basic intention. And he was studying at this university, who's now has seen the light and published their course materials under a license that everybody can take. It's expensive to go to MIT. Sure. Oh, should we say yes? There you have it. So we have actually a good example that Plato's academy could have existed today under the Hacker ethic. Yes, so if you have any questions concerning the part on the Weber and Himanen, we should take them now and then go over to Yuvei's presentation on how free software can be seen in a different sense. Yes, Graham.
So Weber wrote that there is a very long history of people discussing it, disputing it, claiming that it really, the prosthetic really didn't have such a big impact, it was more material conditions. And so it's just an enormous discussion around Weber's thesis. Has there been any, is there any sort of equivalent discussion around Humanus' thesis? Are there people who have come out strongly against Humanus, the same way some people have disputed Weber?
I've come across a few sites at discussions of Himanen in various places, but not, you know, not the same. It hasn't made the same impact yet. One of my first findings were Stefan's review of the book, actually. So I came across it and I tried to follow what was in Oikonuk's project, but I didn't. There was a lot of things, but I mean, I was given the advice at the university to read this book, so it has drawn some attention from various places, and it's Himanen is himself a very prominent figure in Finland, and he has been in the National Council, so I think his. He has a strong position, but I mean, Weber is exceptional in many ways. So, I mean, they're not. None of them are anonymous figures. So,
but isn't there a fundamental difference between the approaches of Weber and Himanen, as far as I understand? I mean, Weber from the beginning was very skeptical and critical against capitalism and the spirit of capitalism. And you quoted the very famous, like this iron cage.
Yes.
And Himanen, in my opinion, is a very idealistic, and not very sociological approach towards the hackers. I mean, Max Weber would have been the first who would have very carefully analyzed the preconditions of the hackers' ethics, like, for example, the modern differentiation of modern society, the modern differentiation of work, or the post-work situation, the situation that we have a very strong social security system on which a lot of hackers are somehow freed to follow their passions and their ideas, and many more in this direction. So Hacker would be, Weber would be very, very aware of these things and interested in these things, whereas as far as I understood, Himanen is painting a very realistic picture of an ethic which seems to be somehow effluent, somehow detached from any sociological preconditions.
Yeah, but you would also you said that Weber was an idealist, and you've said that Himmelen also seems to be an idealist, but in the abstract sort of. And we should compare there. This is a study by as a Protestantisch-Jiddisch study over hundreds of years, and he had a lot of sources. And the Hegel ethic is termed in 1984, so perhaps we don't have much many sources for that either. So there's a difference in the time period that you could reconstruct, and I would generally say the same as you, that it's not the same method to analyze the things going on. Actually, Himmelen is proposing something. He's saying this is perhaps a good way to do things, while as he has already excluded the historical dimension that Weber tried to do. In fact, Weber was based his some of his conclusion on statistical findings that his student had done. I don't remember his real name, Offenbacher or something like that. And it has shown later that perhaps these statistical material wasn't quite the same as Weber took it to be. Therefore, the whole idea of saying that the Protestant were the reason that we had capitalist society is not true, when the presupposition that the Protestant ethic were wealthier, if that is not true, then you could not. It makes no sense, and I think Himmelen points this out and says that, well, Weber was wrong on that point, and I think I'll just say that Protestant ethic and capitalist spirit is the same. So he can do it like that in a snap, and he can say we have capitalism and we have Hegelism. So you're right, it's not based, it's not rooted in historical data, but at the same time you'd have to again try to read this book and try to go in details with Himmelen's work, because he has a lot of observations that hadn't been made before, like saying that Plato was also a hacker and stuff like this. It's very, for me to see, a very precise observation by Himmelen.
Okay, maybe we should start
with
my presentation.
Yes. Right, can I just, when I'm restarting, then I would like to use this privilege to express a little bit of my view about Pika Himmelen's work. Because unlike his very rosy view about what hacker is, I actually consider Cracker's type of hacker as well. And that's the reason why we need hacker ethic. Because if we think hacker are good people, then why don't we want, why we just don't need ethic anymore? Because we need ethic because they are not perfect. And so as most of you have mentioned, actually hacker is kind of culture, it's kind of mindset. So it's something that could be manipulated and something could be performed. So I think I consider Cracker as kind of hacker, that they are performed their opinions to against the world, even though it might be illegal, but it's their expression. So that's my postmodern view about what hacker is. Hence that my approach is very postmodern, which I have a very broad interpretation about what hacker is. And I would like to look in at the very practical part, how the hacker culture is actually implemented in our real world. And actually, you will see that when you are implement the hacker culture in the real world, because it allows you to say something freedom, and allow freedom, allow democracy, and so most of the thing is very dynamic and diverse. So you will see that later I'm going to show you the Emacs, the Emacs case, and you are going to see that Emacs is actually, there are many divisions of Emacs. There are not only the Emacs, there are many different versions of Emacs. And that's the how people show their different opinions about the production, about the innovation of when they are. Right, so as I said, I think the world is very diverse, and that's the reason why when we implement the hacker culture in the real innovation system in the software production, the innovation system is actually very dynamic, that you can't actually predict what's going to happen. So, I say that I portrayed this hacker world. It's a very homogeneous, very diverse world, and just to play the word with Emacs. So I redefine what is Emacs. Emacs is an epistemologically multiple actor-centered system. So my approach is actor-centered, which means I'm looking at how the people really do in this innovation system, rather than just saying very idealistically, saying, oh, what hacker actually is. So I used Emacs as an example, as a, to do my case study, because Emacs provide a variable illustration of the heterogeneous and contingent flows world, which I define flows as free, liberal, open source software. And apart from that, Emacs also show also illustrates a live proof of a GPL product. I think it's the first GPL product in the world that's maintained, developed by Richard Stallman. So far, Emacs has been, if you are counting back to the MIT time, which is 1976, the first Emacs written for TACO. So far, Emacs is almost 30 years old. But if you are looking at GNU Emacs, it might just, which is developed in 1985 or 1986, so far it's like almost 20 years old. But it's the one of the oldest software still alive and still very active community, supported by the community. And third reason I choose Emacs is because it's widely deployed in multiple sites for various uses. So you could use it for web browsing, for gaming, and for if you need psychologists like me, when I'm fed up with my thesis writing and need someone to talk to, you could always put up with your Emacs psychologist and to talk to an Emacs psychologist. So there are multiple sites, even though Windows users could download Emacs and to do the text editing. And in also, Emacs shows a complex network between actors. And in this innovation network of Emacs, you could see many different players, not only the developers, also users and companies, and they work together to develop this. So in my presentation, I'm going to look at the innovation process of Emacsen. Emacsen is the plural form of Emacs, which means there are a variety of Emacs software. And my view is a social technical perspective, which also coming from the postmodern cultural analysis and to look at the diversity in our modern society or late modern society. And I'm looking at diverse actors contribute to multiple ways of knowing, understanding, and resolving problems that arise in the innovation process and how the problems are solved in the software system. And then I'm going to look at the complex interactions and relationship between humans and non-humans. And here the non-humans is the software, which is Emacs. So in this presentation, I will use a list of acronyms. And Emacs, which means editing macros, which is a command strings. And the plural form is Emacsen. Emacs is written originally for the TeCo editor. TeCo means text editor and corrector. It's part of the GNU project, and GNU means GNU is the animals. The first time I've seen GNU is in the zoo, and then people told me this is GNU. I was so shocked to see. I thought GNU is just a software project. No, GNU is really animal. Right, so GNU means GNU is not Unix. And then it's GPL software. GPL means general public license. And my studies is about science and technology studies, and this is a free software. So, but I tend to interpret free software quite broadly, so I would like to call it FLOS, which is free, liberal, open source software. So, now we are going to start the story of Emacs. The background of information about Emacs is it's firstly written in 1976 by Richard Stallman and his colleagues. So please note it that actually this software is not only written by Richard Stallman, it's by him and his colleagues. And many people just ignore his colleagues, but actually his colleague is very important and play a very important role in the innovation process. But the credit should not only go to Richard Stallman. So Richard Stallman and his colleague wrote the editor Emacs to update the previous editor TeCo on an ITS, which is an incompatible time-sharing system. And this system, this software system, running on the PDP-10 minicomputer at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab. And this TeCo editor allow users to employ macros, which is the command strings. In the text-based systems, there's no updated. So you can't see what you are doing without, you have to wait for the machine to come up with the result. But after using this Emacs, you could get what you see is what you get. So you actually, you could have a like real-time reaction with the machine, not only waiting for a machine to react on your command. So basically, you could have a more direct interaction with the machine. So in the innovation process, there's a number of, I recognize them as quite important. For example, of course, Richard Stallman, he wrote the TeCo Emacs, and also later on GNU Emacs. But Carl Mikkelsen, before Richard Stallman, he actually has already developed a very basic what you see is what you get version for TeCo. So actually, Richard Stallman is not the first one come up with these solutions for TeCo to have this what you see is what you get real-time interaction with the TeCo editor. And later on, Richard Stallman, his colleague, Guy Steele, he compiled the macros. So again, this is not Richard Stallman's ideas that he should compile a list of macros that save in the database and to share it with the users. It's actually the ideas from his colleague, which is called Guy Steele. And later on, they worked together with David Moon and Don Weirup. And David Moon later on, I think he moved to industry and he doesn't work in, because in the end of MIT times and many of the programmers, they actually moved down to industry and don't work in the lab anymore. And Don Weirup, how do you pronounce that? Don Weirup. Weirup, okay. And later he produced different versions of Emacs, which is called I and Svi. And I is, like Svi was in Emacs initially, and I is Emacs is nicht I is the nicht Emacs, right? And then later on, there's a Bernie Greenberg. He wrote this Montix Emacs, and also James Gosling Emacs, and later on Jeremy Zavinsky, and he wrote this Lucid Emacs, and later on become X Emacs. So, as far as I have strengthened many, many times, that Richard Stallman is not the inventor of Emacs. Actually, he's just one of the many innovators in the Emacs innovation process. But he's very smart because he came up with this idea of a social contract, which later on became GPL. And with this social contract, when he released the first version of Emacs, he said, Emacs serves as a social contract that renders the communal sharing on the basis of distribution. So he asked the users, not only they could use this social contract to modify and redistribute the code, but on the other hand, they are also being asked to report back the extensions. So the users, they have this obligation to report back what they have done with this software. And in so doing, that users not only could contribute to this project, as well as they will get something back when other people also contribute their comment back to this project, and there will be those information will be stored in the database, and so they would benefit basically everyone using this software. So this social contract is to strengthen the functionality of Emacs and creating a reciprocal understanding of the written codes through sharing solutions. And the solutions is which command string, which is macros you are using. Therefore, the real, I would say, the characteristics as well as the advantage of Emacs is because its extensibility and customization. So, as one of my interviewees, he is an ex-Emacs user, and he says, Emacs is more flexible than any other editor I know. It allows transparent multi-files editing and is easily extendable, and I can modify or create modes if I need to, and has an enormous range of tools such as integrated source code control and programming language specific syntax aware operations, for example, auto-completion and code block matching and block commenting. So basically, it empowers the users and they could kind of improvise their work and to integrate with Emacs. So, Emacs timeline. I'm going to show you this timeline. So this is a timeline, which you could say, I'll just show you another one. Could you say from the back? I hope it's clear enough. So, the first version of Emacs is coming in 1976. It's written for TECO. And later on, you move on. There's Emacs and I and Spy. And Montage is written in different language. Actually, I think this is the first of this Emacs running on this language. And later on, there are more Emacs, Boston Emacs, and so on coming up. And the reason why I'm showing you this list is because how does it
go?
Right. The reason why I'm showing you this is you could see actually the beginning of this innovation system, this innovation network is expanding. Because in the beginning, maybe only people using TECO is using Emacs. Like the first Emacs is written for the TECO language. But later on, that you could see it develop that people using Lisp or any other programming language, they are coming up with different solutions and they are trying to port Emacs to different systems, hardware or software. So you could see the expanding of this social technical network, as well as the digital epistemologies are widened, which means I define digital epistemology as ways of ordering and knowing problems. And these types of digital epistemology, their expressions in the innovation system also wide, also being widened after the development of Emacs. So we can also observe that problems and the way they are ordered, managed and classified are not to be defined independently from a specific time or locale. Rather, they are defined through a process of assembling materials close to hand and using them with others in specific context, which means that when you are developing Emacs, actually you are thinking of the problems at your hands. You are thinking what type of language or what type of system, what type of hardware are you using. Therefore, you come up with different solutions to solve this problem, and you try to improve Emacs and to do this, to make the problem solved in your daily life. So everything is actually situated in the daily life, everyday practice. That's the reason why I think it's quite important to look at the practical part of how to use this, how this software is used and implemented in our daily life. And so, since it's about daily life, and you know, in our daily life, we all have some habits. So I normally like to ask users, different types of user, for different type of software or machines, how they think of these type of software or machines. And when I ask some of my interviewees about their how do they use their Emacs in their daily life, one of them saying, oh, I prefer using Emacs for complicated editing coding job because it's features, but I prefer it for simple and quick jobs like config, file editing, hacking scripts, etc. So it holds this for courses. And the other says, because my fingers are friendly with all the commands I need. So he basically has very much addicted to Emacs, and so he knows exactly which keystroke he has to, press, and when he's using this software, so that he get used to, he have developed some kind of a relationship between this human and non-human interaction. So, we can observe this problem and solution attitude in free software innovation process. So problems and solutions is the necessary elements in the software innovation. So only if you could find the problems, you find a solution, and the solution could be possibly become an element innovation in software system. But also it might be possible it's just your random thought. So one of my interviewees, he says, software, like everything else, is driven by a need to solve a particular problem. There are some developers who are innovative for the sake of being creative. I think commercial software is mainly driven by the market and the need to sell a product, while open source software is driven mostly by the need of solutions, which means in a free software or open source software innovation system, most of the innovation come up from a solution to a specific problem at the programmer's hands. So that's the reason why the free software is often criticized that it's only to fit a specific software programmer's needs. It's not really like useful in the real life. But actually, my view is that if you come up with a solution and you share the solution with other people, it will be improved. It won't just stay there. I think the innovation process in the free software world is unique because it's an ongoing, always dynamic process, because this is open innovation network. Everyone could come in and to join your innovation. It's not only your network. You are trying to attract many different actors to join your network to develop your product. That's the reason why it's unique. So it's not only your decisions. It's more about everyone is influencing your decision, your solutions. Even though the beginning is probably your thoughts, your ideas. So there's this situated solution could be observed in the development of Emacs. Firstly, there are two features could be defined in these situated solutions found in the development of Emacs. The first feature is to define and solving a problem. And in this process, one employs those materials that are available and negotiate or cooperate with actors within or across the boundary set by the problem itself. And there is no standardized path to be followed. Each resolution is a result of a situated practice and knowledge. And the second feature is each episode of problem solving is materially grounded, textured, and situated. So for example, if you want to solve a specific problem and you are looking, firstly, you do a Google search and to find whether there's anyone in the world that they are having the same problem as yours, and then to find out whether there's any solution available. If not, and then you probably ask for other solutions and or come up with something from those materials you have. And if you are using Emacs, then probably you use Emacs to solve your problem. And if you are using VI, then you use VI to solve your problem. So Emacs and problem, and how am I going to conceptualize the Emacs innovation process is I use these problem solving ideas, try to conceptualize this Emacs innovation. So basically, people develop Emacs because they want the efficiency. So once, for example, in the beginning I was telling you that there's another guy called Richard Stallman's colleague, which is called Guy Steeler, and he compiled a range of commands and tried to sorting out the commands rather than just stay in a, just let people freely contribute, keep donating their commands into the database. And because after too many people contribute to this database, it just too messy and everyone has different conceptions. So that's the reason why in this database, it's actually after too many contributions, it's not that efficient anymore to find out what is the right command for your programming, for when you are doing programming, it's not easy to find out the commands. That's the reason why the Guy Steeler, he came up with this idea. He wants to find the most useful commands that could solve the problem. So he tried to solve the problem, which is the efficiency, because the database is not efficient anymore. Even though it's based on a very good will that everyone is sharing their own solutions, everyone is sharing their own commands, but because it's too many, no one to maintain the database, it's just not efficient anymore. So the solution is to come up with a list of the most useful commands and that everyone could do the searching and find the classified commands much more easy. And that's the reason why later on they have a second version of Emacs. It's not, no longer the Tmux, which is only written for Teco language. And the second feature is about the access to the problems. So the social contract actually allow users to access to the problems. Because you know what is the problem. For example, a command is invented because it's invented to do some specific work. And that specific work is actually the problem. So everyone knows which commands is to do with which problems. Knowing the commands is actually knowing the problems. And to solve this problem, maybe some other people have different commands. But as long as you know what's the problems, you have access to these problems, and it's possible that you come up with different solutions. Therefore, that the diverse understanding of the problems will make the boundary of the innovation network elastic. So the boundary of the network is not as restrictive like in a proprietary software. If it's like to do in a Microsoft system, you probably don't know what is the exactly problem, or perhaps you know, but you don't have the source code, you don't know what type of solution has been invented only after they release the product. But that's probably not useful then because you don't have the source code anyway. But with this type of GPL or social contracted software, you have the ability to have an understanding about what is the problem, and you could probably have more access. The problem network is more accessible, so it's easier for you to get a sense about what exactly innovation is taking place. And so everyone could cooperate together. And this is the hacker approach, that to sharing and then to work together. So this problem-solving attitude actually contributes to our innovation system, especially in the software innovation system. So if a problem is more accessible, as I said, that you could have a better understanding about what is a problem, and then there are more diverse actors who will be invited to participate in the innovation group, and which is this innovation group is centering on this specific problem. And there's no perfect solution for a problem because everyone defines perfect differently. And so multiple voices, and even though you are silenced, it's kind of expression of your action as well. So no matter it's voice or silence, they should be always welcome in an innovation network. And if a problem is presented in a perceivable, which is also accessible way, it will encourage more participants to craft the solutions. A well-defined problem in which the given information, operation, and goals are clearly specified will be more likely to have solutions than ill-defined problems. So if you could define a problem more clearly and people could understand your problem better, and you probably will find more people join you and to solve this problem together. So an expert can articulate the inquiries more specifically and completely than could someone new to the domain. So for example, when I'm observing the Linux user group, I find out, firstly, it's quite difficult to understand what the problem actually the user are having, because most of the user group, at least in York, actually they are quite expertise and in computer science. And when they are define a problem, they use a lot of programming language and a lot of technical jargon. It's quite difficult to be understood by the normal users. So that you have specific hierarchy of expertise, that the mailing list seems only for people with a certain level of knowledge to understand the problem. And so the normal users, they have to create another mailing list to solve their own problem at hand. So you see this division of the problems. And taking Emacs as an example, after Richard Stallman's glue, Emacs couldn't solve the problem anymore. For example, couldn't satisfy the other users using different programming language, and they come up with different solutions to develop different Emacs, different versions. And so that's the reason why you see the divergence of the opinions and about problem solving. And if they have different expertise, they will come up with different solutions. And this is how I define how I see this problem-solving attitude and the innovation and how they could work together, and also how to conceptualize the expertise and knowledge in the innovation system. So looking at the innovation process of Emacs, I come up with four important elements in the innovation network. The first one is these innovation elements are specifically found in a free software innovation system. The first one is the teamwork. And if you work together, it's always important about the communication. If you can't communicate with each other, basically it makes no sense to work together, or you would just fight with each other all the time. And the second element I think it's very important in the free software innovation network, it's about materials and social resources. So there are basically two types of resources could be employed in or exploited in developing free software. First one is the material resources, and the other is the social resources. And the third element I define important in free software innovation is the shared interest. Because you have the shared interest, and so you the interest in solving this specific problem, so you work together, you form a team to solve the problem. And even though you have the shared interest in this specific problem, but you need to have the shared goals to work together, otherwise this liaison would just broken. And to sustain these shared goals, you need trust to work together. So the first element, teamwork and communication. When a new member of the team is invited to join this team, that he or she is, they share the same common interest in of this group solving the specific problem. But when these newcomers come into this innovation network, they also bring new ideas into this group, which would pose a little bit uncertainties and risk into this innovation group. And this I'm going to talk about later, how to maintain or how to manage these uncertainties and risk in these innovation networks. And in this teamwork, it appears that the more actors are involved in the team, the better innovation is mobilized, even though it's less easy to maintain a consensus because everyone comes up with them different views. And so, as I said, there will be uncertainties and risk posted in this innovation network because everyone has different ideas about how this problem should be resolved and how this problem should be developed and to be later on, I don't know, come up with different solutions. So because there's probably no consensus and the negotiation is needed and to discuss about this problem has become a crucial aspect of a teamwork. So the negotiation is also communication. So you have to talk to each other. It's not only that I have my own view, that you have your own view. And this communication process is taking place both virtually and face-to-face. And that's the reason why that, the mailing list or the YK site is quite useful to facilitate this type of communication. And even though you located geographically distant, but you could still talk to each other quite easily via the internet or any other information communication technologies. But also there's conferences like Oknux. You could come here to talk to each other face to face. And then when you talk to each other face-to-face, actually, you maintain the trust between each other because when you actually see each other, you can't really be rude to each other. So that's probably the reason why it's necessary to go to different types of Linux conference and to talk to people where you normally fight on the internet. I don't know. And the second element in the innovation networks in the free software innovation network is the material resources and social resources. In terms of material resources, Richard Stallman has this explanation about material resources. He says, a coherent set of new and redefined functions can be bound into a library, the library for Emacs. So this library collects a variety of command strings so that the user can load them together conveniently. Libraries enable users to publish and share their extensions, which then become effectively part of the basic system. By this route, many people can contribute to the development of the system and for the most part without interfering with each other. This has led Emacs 16 to become more powerful than any previous editor. And this type of material resources actually could be quite commonly found in today's free software innovation. For example, like a CVS or Open Archive, they are all this type of material resources to facilitate the free software innovation. And it's quite important to have something material-based that you could actually putting things together. And later, Richard Stallman also mentioned about the social resources, which is another important element in the Free Software Innovation Network. And Stallman says, user customization helps in another subtle way by making the whole user community into a breeding and testing ground for new ideas. Users think of small changes, try them, and give them other users. If an idea becomes popular, it can be incorporated into the core system. When we pull users on suggested changes, they can respond on the basis of actual experience rather than thought experiments. So let's again strengthen the idea of diverse epistemology, a diverse understanding. Even though it's a small difference, will kind of bring a little bit difference into the system, and which might somehow inspire a little bit solution, a little bit different solutions. And let a little bit different will make something unique. And that's the reason why the innovation process of free software is very dynamic and it's unpredictable, less unpredictable, I think, at least compared with the proprietary software. So if we can combine the material and social resources together, and we will find out how Richard Stallman defined. Even though there was no organized political thought relating the way we share software to the design of Emacs, I'm convinced that there was a connection between them, an unconscious connection perhaps. I think that it's the nature of the way we live at the MIT AI lab that led to Emacs and made it what it was. And this possibility, the possibility of Emacs existence is only possible because the combination of material and social resources. Social construction of Emacs. So, because the innovation of Emacs is combine the material and the social resources, actually it's, we can see that the Emacs is not only a cognitive product that come up with only logically, rationally from the computing science. Actually it's a human-made and artificial social construction, socially constructed product. So Stallman's statement points to a key aspect of the social construction of Emacs software, which is the culture of sharing knowledge embedded in the programming practice in the 70s. And this culture of sharing is the social the power of social construction in the innovation of Emacs. So I continue saying that if culture is defined as a way of living, which is invisible and embedded in our daily lives, sharing and exchanging programs is such a programming culture embedded in everyday programming. Stallman adopted this position and tried to sustain it against the wave of commercialization software. And the importance on the hacker culture, which constantly appears in Stallman's writings and speeches, serve to explain the way he designed software in an unconventional way. And my explanation probably will explain why that I want to look at the process, the practical part of programming, and try to find out how the hacker culture is actually implemented and in our design process of the free software. And the third element in the Free Software Innovation Network is the shared interest. And here I quote a French sociologist, Latour, his work about interest is actually the interest. And with this quote, I want to strengthen the importance to find out the shared interest in developing free software. So Latour says the first easiest way to find people who will immediately believe the statement, invest in the project or buy the prototype is to tailor the object in such a way that it caters to these people's explicit interest. As this name indicates, interests are what lie in between actors and their goals, thus creating a tension that will make actors select only what, in their own eyes, helps them reach these goals amongst the many possibilities. And therefore, we can see from Stallman's Thanksgiving message, he posts this message on this the youth group, which is net.unix.wizard, and he called people's attention that he is going to start this project, and this is his message in 1983, 27th of September. And this message shows this, give these messages, and he said creation. So from Stallman's message, we can see that he tried to create a social network of crafting a new operating system. And in posting this message onto the wizard net, that he tried to enroll those people share that same interest. And he probably think that the people on the Unix wizard youth group is probably as smart as him, so that it's more possible to find out the people could solve the problem together. But because he doesn't know who is going to respond to his post, so there's an uncertainty, a risk. But he also tried to open up the problem and solutions network. So a brief summary of what I've so far I've talked about is I'm looking at how a software innovation network is created and developed in terms of classification of problems, identifications of solutions and common interests. I'm also looking at actors and actors are brought together, interact and negotiate with each other to solve problems. And thirdly, I'm looking at the boundaries of networks which determine access to innovation systems vary in different contexts, which is situated in our daily life. And lastly, I'm trying to conceptualize a successful innovation, which is the one that manages to bring in as many actors or artifacts as possible by translating their interests to extend and mobilize the network as well as handles the uncertainties and risks emerging during the process. And then I discussed about the material culture. I said it's important to have the material and to work with the social resources. And so, as I said, there are many different projects of Emacs has developed. But in using different software, actually, you are actually demonstrating your own identity. So if you are more addicted to Emacs, you are actually demonstrating your own personality in using Emacs. But if you are a VI user, you probably define yourself differently from the Emacs user. So there's this holy war always taking place that the people try to argue which type of text editor is better. So basically this is the world, how the world is, a diverse world is presented. And then from the case of Emacs, we could also observe that the specific feature, which is the peer production and the community-based innovation in the development of the Emacs. So my future, actually I've done most of this, and some of my papers could be found on my webpage. But I mean, based on these case studies, what one could try to find out in the future is to extend this analysis of dynamics of software innovation. We can see that how the future work should be focused on the programmers' daily practices and to explore how key innovation resources, both tangible and intangible, tangible being like machines, and intangible, something like software or social resources, are employed. And I think my analysis also contributed to the understanding of the heterogeneous world. So I'm not trying to say that the hacker culture is a perfect solution to produce the software. And I'm not also saying that the business or industry is the only institute or only organization could produce better software. I basically disagree both of this kind of very extreme view. My view is that the software innovation processes in different contexts can be understood in this way without falling into the dichotomy of the moral or immoral, efficient or inefficient, the type of typical arguments about free software and proprietary software. So something I believe that is something employed is to fit into the practical situated needs. And I hope you are not very sleepy as me. Open for questions. Probably just leave it there.
Well, it's not exactly on your original. Actually, we'd like to ask you a remark you made before on feminism.
Sorry, what is your...
Well, you said you made a remark before on the inclusion or exclusion of female women in the room. I know it's not part of this audience, but I would like to hear you now or later.
Which specific person? I argue about women's female's role in software innovation system.
I have a specific question, but the same theme. When you were doing your surveys, did you actually find any women users of Emacs at all, or was it entirely male?
Okay, for example, I have a few. I have 50 face-to-face interviews, and I only got 5 females.
Okay, but I just want to see, were the noticeable differences between those 5? If I looked at the results of your interviews without knowing the gender of the people, would I be able to say, okay, those are the women and those are the men?
Actually, these quotes, the quotes I put here, none of them are from women. And among those 5 female programmers, the first one is working in the German government, and so she tried to maintain the assistance in the German government. And the second one, she is a KDE programmer, so she's actually designed the interface. And the third one, who is actually, she's just a user, it's not really programming anything, but she is a she knows some programming language and so on. And the fourth one, actually, I think she's quite unique. And she's a member of the Linux user group in York. And then she's especially good in writing shell scripting and those kind of things. And they are different. I think especially the one in York is quite different because she actually behaves like a male programmer. So somehow, I think it's a quite private question, but very often she talk about her girlfriend. So I don't know whether she's actually lesbian or not. So, but my view about, I don't know what type of a question are you exactly asking, but of course, the female programmers are quite few in the software programming, these innovation networks. And basically, I think because it depends, if I want to base my arguments on my analysis about problem solving, I think it's probably because the problem presented on most of the innovation network is not really understandable for women, because I think women perceive problems quite differently from men, because women prefer to narrate the problem more rhetorically, not only by programming language, which is a very cognitive, that you always show them that how this problem should be solved and so on. But actually, I think women prefer to talk about a problem by the colloquial language, could be more understandable, more daily life based.
I have a counter-example to that. Knitting castles. Knitting is very light programming. It's almost entirely done by women, although a few men do it. The language you describe it, knit one pearl, one drop, two, knit three. I don't know if there's an equivalent in German or French, but the language to describe knitting is very much like a programming language. And that is quite a female thing. I mean, in terms of who does it, it's women who do that.
Right. And they present their problem and in a programming language way?
Yeah, the description. Does anybody get knit? Okay. Yes, the description for a pattern clothing is very much like an assembly language program. It's not even a high-level language, it's assembly language. For example, my mother really dominates this language very well, and she can talk to other women about it, and they're talking about assembly language. For me.
But are you saying that they show the programming language, or the way they present it is actually?
I'm saying right. The way, if you write down a pattern for knitting, it looks like a program, and that women are quite happy working this way and talking about this thing.
You are probably very. But you are probably unique in understanding this. Probably other people, they don't think so. They just think, oh.
I don't know. Anybody else?
Yeah,
I
have
a
question.
I actually, I'm thinking perhaps you would like to have a look of the Emacs timeline, because I think it's quite interesting. Perhaps you are a VI user, you don't care, but to find out what is the problem of Emacs, because I'm looking at the genealogy of problem, and from this timeline, you could find out which problem is solved, and so which version comes up. And so far, the newest version of Emacs is the XEmacs, which is, I think, February this year, they have the new update. And I don't know whether you'll be interested to have a look about that, and try to see the problem and the solution relationships.
I'm going to show you an answer.
Okay.
Well, it's not really clear which is the problem. Is it more clear than this? So what I'm interested is why there will be specific solving concepts. For example, why would Lucy Emacs suddenly change to X Emacs? And also I'm interested in so I just want to do a little bit brainstorming and to understand about the problem. Is there any patterns about software problems, or it just come up like this? Because Emacs is a very historical example, so what I'm interested in is there, and we can do a little bit comparison about GNU Emacs and the XEmacs web, the development of GNU Emacs and XEmacs as well. Are they solving the same types of problems? And because I personally, I don't have much programming language ability, so I have problem understanding how these programs are defined and how these problems are solved. So if you saw many people here, maybe more
What's your question?
The question is the full Emacs and the exit Emacs look at the pattern and look at the genealogy, the different problems, are solving the same types of problems or not? And what is the same types of problem are solving?
Well, as far as I understand the history of these two maps, is that there was a fault which was motivated by using extraneous maps. I'm not sure about this, but
no, I'm not really an
Emacs
user. I vaguely get some detail.
Well, this is basically the fork, as far as I know. It was called Lucid MS for quite a long time. I don't know why they changed the name. I think it is not in Polish. Just Lucid is something after something like that, and they changed it for some reason. But of course, parallel, we did all kinds of the same thing about it. And of course, they had to solve the same problem as Crowbars, for instance, at 1994, another thing which you would not like to miss in any region today. And so both had to invent this. But as far as I can see, if you look at maps, then there are two perspectives. The one perspective is the Crowbar engine, which is rather small. As far as I can see, and then you have a really huge code base of what you might call macros, which is actually this program. And it's a pain in the ass to write Lisp programs for both Emacs. Usually, there are small differences. And this is the most difficult thing. The interesting thing is that people often try to write code for both Emacs versions. And so the code bases of both Emacs versions give to each other. They are shared to a high degree, and you can see that when you look at the code, you can often see, well, this is because of XMS, and this is because of UMS, and this is because of to support Emacs until 19.7 or something like that. And so they are not in this, they are not competing as they would be. Proprietors of their products, but there's a lot of sharing among them. And there are also always thoughts about merging these two Emacs together, but I don't know what the situation is at the moment. A few years ago, I heard that they are trying this view. Sorry for a bit rambling.
But as you say, it's just small differences, but it has come up with different versions of
things. Yeah, but so these differences came about because they had the same problems, but because they had not such close cooperation, they developed different solutions. And for instance, font management is quite different, and how the keys are rotated in Emacs and Emacs, there are small differences, and there's no fun to handle this, but it is possible.
From my vague memory of the past of this, which may not be accurate, but I think
it's a mistake to overestimate the technical parts and underestimate the personal parts and the personalities involved. And Stallman's disagreements with James Gosling and the elusive, I believe, was called elusive because Gosling wasn't there in an attempt to set up the company around Emacs, and it was going to, Stallman felt that this was privatisation and reacted against it, which is why initially it was quite hard for the two to work together. And now that problem has gone away, but because you have a technical history now and differences, it's become hard to re-merge. I don't know, I think I know a lot of this is documented. I didn't know it at one time, and I know you can find the details of these things. And I would look, if I was doing this, I think I would look for personal and political differences as much as the technical ones as the driver of this process. The other thing is, I'm not an Emacs user, so I don't know how this works with the libraries, but my impression was that the library functions that you have for Emacs was the first actually large pool of available programs, although they're not technically programs, because they're dependent on Emacs itself, but it was the first interesting pool of cooperatively developed tools. And that it would be just as interesting to look at them and the growth of those and where those came from as to look at Emacs or XEmacs as a package in itself, but also look at the libraries as a separate issue.
Can I have another question? Do you find it useful to analyze this type of, to have this type of case studies? Or do you just find it that it's not really important? I don't know, what's your view about it? I mean, to understand the...
I think trying to understand things is always important, and if you can look at it and draw general conclusions from it, then you can apply to other things. Of course it's important.
How far are you inviting?
Thanks.